Thank you very much for coming and thanks for the introduction. And apologies because I'm not actually a very natural speaker, so if I slow down and stop, you know, just ask me some questions or something. But I've, you know, being thrown into the experiences that we have in the last year, I mean, I went on the land convoy. I've recognised a friend from the land convoy here as well, and now this, it's sort of it's made me better at speaking, I hope. So I'll try not to bore you too much. Just quickly about personally, how I managed to get onto the Mavi Marmara is friends from the land convoy and needed somebody to take a truck to Istanbul to put stuff onto the ship, onto one of the cargo ships. We'd missed the Rachel Corrie because the vehicle wasn't ready in Ireland, so the only option was to take all the stuff that was like medical equipment and shoeboxes, 125 shoeboxes of just presents for children, over to Istanbul and put it on the cargo ship there. So last minute I was asked to go, but of course I knew the flotilla was happening because I've been in touch with flotilla organisers since the land convoy, and I had this feeling that I was going to somehow be on those boats because I actually resigned from my job a month before the departure date. Just had a sense that I might need to not be working, and that happened on the last day of my work. I had to just take this vehicle over to Turkey and put the stuff onto the ship, and the people at IHH, you know, I knew them from the land convoy, and they said, "Oh, you're not on the list, but I think we can get you on." And they put me on the list at the last minute, and I was really overjoyed to get onto the Mavi Marmara. I mean, really, having worked with IHH on the land convoy and now here, I just really have so much respect for them as an organisation. The way that they recognise that the humanitarian situation in Gaza is not going to change unless people do actions like this, and the way that they had foreseen the media battle that was needed, and they installed the equipment that was required onto the ship to make sure that anything that happened to us was broadcast. And, you know, that's one of the most amazing things that they've managed to achieve there, is to get those images out that I think probably most of you might have seen by now. Forgive me, I don't know how much of you have seen everything that happened there, but what was happening before the attack was really a beautiful thing. I mean, the ship itself had such a diverse group of people on it. It was perfect for the purpose. You know, everyone could sit around on the decks and have discussions and talks and singing and talking about positive projects and constructive things that they wanted to do in Gaza. Alpha Kura education project that sponsors people's degrees had taken 65 laptops to give to the students. We had an Indonesian delegation. They actually had the plans and the civil engineer and the doctors coming to build a hospital in Gaza, and that's what they were going to do. IHH themselves have got a program in Gaza sponsoring 10,000 orphans, supporting 10,000 orphans there, and we were going to go and visit some of those children. I'm particularly interested in young people. I work in the youth offending service, or I did used to work in the youth offending service, and, you know, all of the academic research I've read about young people's development is that if you disrupt their childhoods and traumatise them in the way that's happening in Gaza, then by the time they get to the teenage years, you've got serious problems. So I was interested initially to visit Gaza for that reason. I can't understand why a population that's majority children is being punished in the way that it is. Anyway, so the ship was going along, and you know, we had beautiful things like, in some way, the staff were able to make kofta kebabs for the entire 600 people on the ship at 6 o'clock every day, and we all came together sort of very much collectively, and then on Saturday, Sunday afternoon, we had managed to get together with all the other cargo ships. Everyone was ready, so there were six boats all together by 4:30 on the Sunday, and we just set off through the evening and through the night. And for me, it was about 11-ish, 12-ish, you sort of became aware sort of from other passengers that there was a threat, or boats had been detected on the radar. That information went round, and immediately we were all told to try and get our life jackets on and, you know, get into position, as in the ladies had to go down to where the women's quarters were and, you know, wait and try and keep safe. then it kind of went quiet for a while, a couple of hours, and the broadcasting was carried on from upstairs, from the live deck. The back of the ship was set up, the upper deck, with broadcasting going on all the time. I met Sama on the boat, and he made me work with him with the satellite phones, which meant I had to sit for hours with the satellite phone like that, pointing towards the sky. But it was essential that that happened. I mean, we had, during the day on Sunday, I think we had a contact with Venezuela. We had one Venezuelan member, and he managed to get onto the TV channel in Venezuela, and that reached,
45 interviews. Great.
It reached millions of people. The story reached millions of people. So the broadcasting was continuing, and it was felt that it was really important for us to continue broadcasting the humanitarian message and get us out onto the deck again. So I came back out about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we did some interviews, and, you know, we had a Union Jack as well, which, you know, just tried to remind the audience of the diversity of the group. And then the light went off, I think. One of the lights on the decks went off. Didn't know what that was, but I thought, well, I'm going to go down and try and send an email. And I went down, and it was a scary moment when I tried to press send on the email, and I realised that the satellite had been jammed and there was no way I could send it. And I thought, oh, something, you know, that's pretty scary now. Immediately went out of the press room, and I could see these small boats coming alongside the ship, and the noise of the helicopter had appeared overhead, just metres above me, and I sort of couldn't believe this was happening. I thought, I'm shouting cowards over the side of the boat, and thought, I don't think that's going to deter them. But then, yes, everything happened very quickly after that. It was very intense. Turned round and tried to go into the stairwell of the ship. There were loud bangs. First anxiety was that, well, what if they sink it? You know, it's a second-hand day ship from sailing around the sort of Bosporus area. It's not, you know, maybe not meant to be sailing across the Mediterranean. But I could see lots of commotion. There was an Israeli soldier, actually, that had already come down the inside stairwell, and guys were restraining him, and there was a guy at his head saying, calm down, it's all right, calm down. And a woman was there saying, don't hurt him, don't hurt him. And he had a kind of bloody nose, and he seemed like he might have been winded. He could have been one of the guys that fell off the deck. But anyway, I wanted to make sure that he was okay. You know, I witnessed that he was fine, and so I kind of went on. After that, just the sheer number of people and the amount of blood was the next memory I can recall, which is people just coming down, you know, holding their limbs and just blood pouring out of their limbs, and people lying down, you know, very pale and terrified because they've been injured. They don't know how serious it is. They don't know if they're going to bleed to death. You know, just trying to stay calm and thinking, well, what can I do? Next thing I remember, a stretcher is called for, and ran upstairs with the stretcher with another guy, and we went onto the top deck. And, you know, I didn't realise at the time, we took the stretcher around to a man who was lying along on the floor, and tried to put him on. And I was worried about, how are we going to get him down to the medical room? And, you know, somebody just took my arm and just said, just don't worry about that. And I realised that he was shot dead. He was already dead then, so I hadn't realised that. He, in fact, is the same person that probably Sama will talk about. And, you know, when we hear about the reason being given by the Israeli Defence Forces, that self-defence was why they had to pull their guns out, you know, I really find it impossible to understand how you can shoot the official photographer of the ship while he's holding a camera on a lower deck from where the guns are and call that self-defence. And that's what happened to him. He was a cameraman. The footage that we've got shows him minutes, seconds before he was shot dead holding his camera. I don't know how anyone can explain that. So once the captain and the leader, Bulent, had realised that this situation was a live ammunition situation, they asked us all to stop resisting and to just sit down. So we sort of made our way, well, I made my way down to the salons. I thought, right, we just need to do what we're told here. And everything, all the chaos sort of slowly calmed down the next 2 hours. people were sitting down in the salons. There was a medical room on the boat, and that was filled with people. I think there were probably 39. Well, I know there were 39 because I counted off afterwards, but 39 sort of injured people in that room being treated. And as I was sitting where I was sitting in the salon, they started bringing the bodies in. So there were four dead men lying very close to where I was sitting, and it was a very surreal experience. And you know, I think I had a lot of adrenaline, so you know, I was pretty much numb, and I think that numbness stuck with me until we finally got in. Well, once we'd been on the ship all day and we'd been processed through Ashdod and we'd gotten to prison, the next day after that, we were constantly asked to have consular access. We wanted them to come to the ship. They weren't allowed to. They wanted to see them at the port. They weren't allowed in there. Eventually, I saw British consulate on the, must have been the Tuesday afternoon. And when I found out the massive response and the massive impact and the amount that the media and the world had kind of become aware of what happened, that's when my emotion came out, because I realized what we'd done, really. I realized that what these people had done, what they'd given their lives for, was to expose the brutality of the Israeli Defense Forces, and that's when I felt the emotion. It's been very surreal, the whole experience coming back. We've been amazingly looked after by the Turkish government and the Turkish organisation that we travelled with. I mean, when we got back, the first thing they wanted us to do was to go for a full health check, you know, blood tests, urine samples, psychiatric assessment, everything. Turkish government chartered the planes that brought us back to Turkey. They wanted to bring everyone. They didn't sort of just select the Turkish nationals. It was, you know, you guys have been through this horrendous experience, you're all coming with us. And that was that amazing feeling of stepping onto the Turkish plane after being in Israeli custody and just feeling like this weight of relief, and the trust the people that you can see. And when we got back to Istanbul, they put us up in hotels, and they just said, right, your accommodation's paid for, your food's paid for, your flight, when you want to travel, this is it. I mean, the contrast with our consulate, who sort of said, if you've lost all your money, you can fill out this form and you can borrow some money and pay it back within 2 months. Right. Thank you. They actually said, go and talk to Turkish Airlines. So going to the... I mean, all of us felt we should stay to go to the funeral. Sarah Colburn came back, and she wanted to come back and, you know, speak as a director of the PSC at press conference as soon as possible. So she came back early, but the rest of us stayed for these amazingly emotional funerals with, you know, thousands of people on the streets in Istanbul, and the support that we got there was phenomenal. Coming back here afterwards, finally, you know, I actually, I mean, I'm not used to speaking to the press and media at all. And I found my family had actually done a lot of that, and I thank them immensely for the way that they coped with the media. But I've kind of, going back to your point about, you know, coverage of the issues, I actually now, I want them to say the Israeli lines. I want them to say this sort of unbalanced questions that we get, because I'm finding it a lot easier to put them down. And I think also the British public now will find it a lot easier to see through. I don't think they swallowed the story that the Israelis tried to give from the outset. I'm not sure if I'm right, because it's hard to be objective. So, yeah, not being a good public speaker, I'm not going to have a massive conclusion or anything, but I hope it's given you a little flavour of what my experience has been like. And it hasn't stopped yet, and it hasn't stopped us and our determination. It's made me a lot more determined to be involved longer term. So, yes, I hope I'll be seeing you all again. I'll definitely be on a ship back to Gaza as soon as possible.
Thank you very much, Alex. And I don't think you should run yourself down. You did spoke with emotion, and I'm sure people appreciate it.